to approve the minutes as they stand.
Second.
You second it?
Okay, thank you.
I did.
Well, thank you. So, just so we can. Sorry. I'm not good at Robert's rules. All in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. So, I thought we could just go around and introduce ourselves, help everyone with names and what you do. So my name is Stephanie Royce-Mashta. I represent a nurse practicing in Clark County, and I work on an outpatient mental health unit with Peace Health.
My name is Melanie Maiorino. I'm the behavioral health ombuds in Southwest Washington.
My name is Tracy Rood, and I represent Consumer.
Jeremy Scott, I'm the chief performance officer at Clark County Recovery Health, and I oversee our environmental and public health programs.
Remy Houston, representing the Devil community.
Alan Melnick, I'm the public health director and health officer.
Don Strick, DIO, Clark County Public Health.
Chris Goodwin, community engagement coordinator, Clark County Public Health.
Marlon Sanger, director of community benefit for Peace Health.
Adrienne Fairbanks, I represent the veterinary community and veterinary practicing in Clark County.
Arlen Murphy, and I represent the medical doctor in Clark County.
Sandy, do you want to jump in real quick?
Sandy Matheson, I'm the Director of Social Emotional Learning for the Battleground School District. I represent schools.
My name is Janelle. I work at Seymour Community Health Centers, and I'm just a public member.
And I'm Roxanne Wolf. I'm the Chief Operations Officer with Public Health.
I'm Keisha Gauthier. I am a nurse working at Legacy Hospital, so I'm not just any length.
Wendy Silverthorne, I'm the SMART team coordinator.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a nurse, but I sit on the council as the non-elected representative from the city of Vancouver.
I'm Cindy Meyer. I'm the program manager for chronic disease prevention at Clark County Public Health.
Jonathan Durlow, I'm the managerial coordinator for SMART.
Scott Johnson, I'm the emergency manager for Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency, and I'm representing emergency communication and emergency management.
And I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief at Battleground, Washington, and I represent the law enforcement council, which is all of the police chiefs and the sheriff of Clark County.
Paul Childers and I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
John Rock, Clark County Utilities, and Clark Water Specialist, I represent the Clark County Water Utility.
Mark Collier representing septic designers, installers, and maintenance specialists.
Dave Scott, City Administrator for the City of West Eagle, and I am a non-elected representative of 11 county cities and towns that aren't Vancouver. The small cities.
Well, welcome everyone. So we have a full group today, which is great. And we have Quinton and Jonathan both joining us, and thank you so much. I was wondering if you wanted to share with the group any thoughts about public health or what led you to the meeting today?
For me, I manage a team of navigators who help with insurance enrollments within Clark County's Canadian Click Attack, and so both for Medicaid and qualified health plans. And as news seems to change and insurance coverage seems to change, it's very beneficial for the public to know as well.
So for me, I live in Washington, Oregon. I work up here. I know being part of like councils and committees is, you know, have your voice heard and the people you serve. So I was kind of curious. I looked online. I got in touch with Chris and also looked at the website, and I was like, I didn't really see representation of kind of community health, but at CMAR. So, you know, I feel like, you know, we're at the table. We're not really at the table. I'd like to be there. I'd like to, you know, have our input because, you know, again, he said with the news, there's been a bunch of facilities that don't take Medicare patients, and there's a huge flood of them, and so we've opened 5 clinics here to get that, so I think our voice needs to be heard because we have something to say, so, you know, that's why I'm here, and I know being on the committees in King City where I live, that's important to have that voice, so, yeah.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to move ahead with the department update. Dr. Romani, would you like to start?
Sure. So this is, you may have heard that in the news. Can everybody hear me okay?
Do we need the microphone?
I mean, I'm pretty loud. So. Can you guys all hear me down there? I can look it up. Oh, really? Wow, we have a computer set on one mic. You're going to get a lot of exercise here.
We can
practice. Okay, I'm sure. Okay. We might slow things down a little bit, but I'm sure we can pass it around. So, we had an outbreak of chickenpox at Walnut Grove Elementary School in April and into May. The last known exposure to the school happened May 31st. There were 9 cases of chickenpox at Walnut Grove. Based on that, given that we had an outbreak there, you may have heard that we basically issued exclusion we required exclusion for all susceptible, which means unvaccinated or previously uninfected folks, both staff and students at the school. We had 8 to 10 staff who did not have evidence of immunity either by lab test, by documentation of having the disease, or by being vaccinated. We had about 35 students who did not have, were unvaccinated and couldn't otherwise demonstrate immunity. So we issued exclusion orders for all of them. They could go back to school or work if they got the first dose of the vaccine or if they demonstrated by blood test that they were immune or they had a physician documentation or healthcare provider documentation that they previously had the disease. As a result, when our schools, I think we already had the last day of school, so the timing was actually fortunate. We ended up, all the staff were able to return because they were able to do one of those 3 things, and all but 7 students were able to return, so we ended up ultimately excluding 7 folks. And I'm unaware of any new cases, so now that summer's beginning, it looks like it's over. So I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. Yes?
I know that some parents choose not to immunize. I don't understand that, but were the 7 that didn't return, was it by choice that they didn't want to get the treatment over there?
Right, so that's a really good, and I should have mentioned this. So Walnut Grove had one of the higher exemption rates in the county. And what I mean by exemption rates, there's 3 ways that you can exempt your child from the vaccination requirements. One is religious. One is a medical reason that they can't be vaccinated. Let's say if it's a live vaccine and they have an immune disorder or some other contraindication. And the other one is a philosophic exemption. Believe in it. If you get a philosophic exemption, you have to get a note from, or a personal exemption, whatever you want to call it. I like to call it philosophic, but you have to get a note from the healthcare provider that you understand what the risks and benefits are and you still choose not to vaccinate your kid. The vast, vast majority of exemptions, both locally in the state of Washington, are philosophic. There's very few, very small number of religious. There aren't many religions that are opposed to vaccination, and there are very few medical contraindications, so the vast majority are philosophic. So most of those 28 kids, the parents either got the vaccine or were able to demonstrate immunity, but 7 chose not to. And within that 7, there might be a child who was unvaccinated due to medical reasons. And I believe there was one child who had some sort of immune problem and needed to be remained out. But that's another reason why that kids who don't have contraindications, parents should get them the vaccine because we need to protect kids who can't get vaccinated. Yes?
Are parents able to review that data for the school for that their children attend so they have an awareness of like what the unvaccinated rates are?
You can actually, that's a really good question. The rate was over 10%, so that information was available in terms of what we put out. I don't know, the state has a website where you can look at the vaccination rates by school. We didn't get the the exact information out, but there are published data about the vaccination rate by school and school district. Yes.
How many, what percent of the population needs to be vaccinated in order for there to be protection?
So that's a really good question. So one of the main reasons for getting everybody vaccinated is reduce what's called herd immunity. So herd immunity means that you have enough people vaccinated in a population, the virus or whatever the disease is can't be transmitted very easily. It runs into a bunch of dead ends, you know, people who are immune. Where something is exquisitely contagious as chickenpox, I believe the herd immunity is somewhere in the low 90s, between somewhere like 92 to 94% or so, or at least that much. The other problem with chickenpox, in which we realize we really need, and why vaccination is the best way to prevent transmission, is that there's that characteristic rash of chickenpox, that blistery, we call them vesicles rash, but you can be contagious for up to 2 days before that rash begins, and all that you might have is fever and viral-like syndrome of being really tired. So you don't know that you have chickenpox when you're first contagious. So it's really important to get that herd immunity up to into the 90s. And this school had a exemption rate that was put their vaccination rate was below 90%. You might have been hearing it was an outbreak of measles back in Minnesota in a population of Somali immigrants that had previously high vaccination rates, really high vaccination rates, and then folks from the anti-vaccination movement got to them and convinced them that their kids were at risk of autism, and their vaccination rates went down into the 40% range, and they had just had a large outbreak of measles there. So it's really important to have herd immunity. So when I tell people about vaccinations, they don't just do it to protect your child, but do it to protect everybody else. And in a school, one of the big concerns is pregnant women, because they're at high risk of varicella pneumonia, which can be deadly, and their children are at risk for congenital herpes zoster, so the baby. So that's another thing to be concerned about. Any other questions? I can pontificate about immunizations for a while. The other thing was the state budget update. So we talked about this last time about our ask for foundational public health services. The governor recommended $20 million, the House $40 million, and the Senate $0 for foundational public health services, which would be a substantial funding increase for us. They're in their second special session and they're not done yet. So they have to pass a budget by the end of June, and if they don't pass the budget by the end of June, then the state basically shuts down. So, which could affect us as well, because if the state shuts down, our grant funding shuts down, but we're prepared to use some fund balance for that first month. If that happens, we will be meeting regularly to develop a contingency plan. But I don't know if Janice or Roxanne want to add anything to that, but we're hoping and praying that the state, as many of you who might be involved in getting any state funding as well, hoping and praying that they finish the budget by the end of, by June 30th. I don't know if there's any questions about that.
All right.
Oh, you're going to
my turn, yes. I promise I will not say, although I'm very tempted at this point. So I just wanted to give a really quick update on the bylaws and then also the Nurse Family Partnership Program. So we've been working on our bylaws. We've been having, you guys actually have a good rep in the community, so we're starting to get more and more requests for back letters of support and advocacy for our community partners. And one of the things we wanted to do is really make sure that we have, it's clear in our bylaws what FAC can and cannot do. So FAC, really the sole purpose of FAC is to advise the Board of Health. And I have a meeting with the prosecuting attorney's office. What we're going to do is we're going to update the bylaws a little bit to make sure that it's very, very clear what we can and can't do, so our community partners understand when it is that we, how it is that we would go about supporting
you know, supporting an issue that someone would bring to us. And we'll be putting some procedures together as well that we'll be sharing with, hopefully by the next meeting we'll be sharing with you. So I just want to give you a quick update on that. Are there any questions on bylaws or any of that? And then real quick update on Nurse Family Partnership Program. So things are going really well. We were approved for the designated state health program funds, and our application. And Jeff had talked about that at a meeting or two ago. That actually will provide up to a one-to-one match for our Nurse Family Partnership Program. So we've been able to apply for those funds. We have a preliminary approval that we were approved to apply for those funds. Now the next step will be, what is it going to be, a one-to-one match, or how is that going to work? So we're still working on that piece of it. Obviously, I'm very confused because I wasn't very eloquent in stating that. The good thing is that we were approved for applying for those funds. Second step is just figuring out if we're actually going to get a full one-to-one match for the funding that we requested. The funding will actually go through to our ACH, and then the ACH, we've been working with them to provide that funding back for our NFP program, and so we're also working on that at the same time. So that's great news. We're also working very closely with our community partners. Those conversations are going very, very well. A couple of other things, we've been approved to be a MolTIPS pilot for our NFP program. NFP is Nurse Family Partnership. I should not talk in acronyms. MolTIPS are women that have had multiple pregnancies. So currently our program is only for first-time low-income moms. We've now been approved for a pilot program with an NFP program to actually serve women who have had multiple births. So that's awesome. So we can actually expand services. The second thing that we've been approved to do is telehealth. So our Nurse Family Partnership is in the home. It's very extensive case management. The NSO, the National Service Office, has allowed some expansion to allow some telehealth for those moms that don't necessarily need a visit every single time. So that's really great news as well, and that will also help us to expand our reach in our program. So that's basically it in a nutshell. Any questions? Yes.
I know that the telehealth will be very beneficial to people who live in rural areas like Skamania or whatever. And I'm wondering, what if there is someone who's involved in the program, but they don't have the computer, laptop, whatever, and the internet connection? Or
then we go to them. Okay. Yeah. Then it will still be a home visiting. And it truly is. It's a home visiting program, so we still will encourage the nurse to go to visit the home, especially in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And when we're establishing those relationships, we do want to be in the home. But sometimes people don't necessarily have a home, or you know, they're in between homes, you know, or they may not have a particular spot that they feel comfortable bringing the nurse into. So we want to make sure that they don't miss their appointments with the nurses, that they don't miss those opportunities to have those conversations. So it's just one more tool in the tool chest, you know, kind of. Great question. Any other questions? Great, thank you.
No, I can speak loudly. I'm not afraid. Okay, so just a committee update is that we have a few people whose terms in this committee will be up on September 30th. So just to let you know, those positions that are happening September 30th would be ready. A dentist practicing in Clark County, and then Tracy. Tracy represents Consumer Public Health Services, and Sandy, our Clark County Educational Community, and then Bob Richardson, so he's the representative from Clark County Law Enforcement, and then Dave, so representative from CRESA. So just as a reminder for members that would like to continue or be reappointed, then they can provide a formal signed letter stating interest for that. Okay, so just a brief statement before presentations for tonight. One of the topics that we've been discussing for the past few meetings has been the issue of youth suicide in our county. So we'd like to spend some time discussing the services available. for the existing programs for youth. So we brought up a few questions during our discussions, including, you know, what is the extent of youth suicide in our county? What is the expert perspective on why suicide is happening? What is our community doing to help mitigate this problem? And how are youth voices being included in programs and mitigation efforts? So we've got a few speakers tonight to talk about these questions, and we're looking forward to what's happening in the community. So I believe that Joan is going to get started and will talk to us about ACEs and the Action Alliance.
As Joan is queuing that up in her packet, there's also a presentation, a copy of the presentation, which is, this is a great educational material, so we wanted to include this and you can take notes. We'll also make sure that any presentations that are given tonight will be part of the notes going out as well. So anything you don't have in the packet, we'll also be including those in the notes.
So this is an overview of ACEs, and it's a presentation that Cindy Meyer and I are giving in the community, and I really want to thank Cindy for her leadership and working with us on the ACEs Action Alliance, because this is a presentation that we've developed together, and it's also the genesis of the presentation that she gave to the Board of Health in May. So we're trying to align what we're presenting here with what our Board of Health knows. So we'll get to more information about the ACEs Alliance later. So, you know, so we look at, you know, we're talking about youth suicide tonight, and, you know, how, where ACEs fits in. But ACEs is really across the lifespan. It's not just about early learning and childhood. It affects our health and well-being across the lifespan and contributes significantly to chronic disease. And if you look at the issues we have in this country with our healthcare spending, 75 cents of every healthcare dollar goes for chronic disease. 7 out of every 10 deaths in the U.S. is caused by chronic disease. And 54% of ER visits are made by high ER utilizers. And, you know, there's a high cost to this. And so if we can really go, and so ACEs is about upstream. It's going upstream. It's going upstream to prevent chronic disease. And so there's a lot of literature about this. I'm not going to go into it much more, but if you have questions, you can ask later. So for those of you that haven't heard of ACEs before, it's coming out of a study done in the mid-90s by a Kaiser physician, Dr. Folletti, and a CDC physician, Dr. Anda, where they looked at 17,000 middle-class, college-educated people in the San Diego area, and did histories in terms of looking at they were dealing with people who were overweight and had cardiac disease, and went back and looked at, did extensive health histories of them to find out, and not just health histories, but histories of their life, and were able to, using statistics, demonstrate a significant relationship between the amount of adversity you had in your childhood and whether or not you would have chronic disease, and not just behavioral health issues, substance use disorders, homelessness, teen pregnancy, but a higher risk of cardiac disease, a higher risk of lung disease. And so the study findings have been replicated in subsequent studies, and it is one of the studies in healthcare that is now being called a seminal study that's really changing the paradigm of health, the way we think about healthcare. So what they found in the ACEs study were 10 different categories which impact a child or somebody that's up to about age of 18. These are physical abuse, emotional abuse, and sexual abuse. So three kinds of abuse. Two kinds of neglect, physical and emotional neglect. And then what they characterized as family dysfunction, which included a family member having mental illness, depression, or suicide, a family member with substance use disorders or addiction, parental discord, meaning separation, divorce, or being abandoned, a child observing domestic violence, or a family member who'd been incarcerated. And we know, and I have a slide later on that really talks about, adverse community environments, but because we know that if a child that grows up in poverty or in homelessness and experiences institutional racism, which is prevalent in our society, it also contributes to them developing an adverse, an ACEs score, an adverse outcome. So what we've seen with high ACE scores is that it correlates with increased health risk, chronic disease, and poor health outcomes. And I have a slide just a minute that will give you some specific numbers, but we're talking here about the relationship between adversity in childhood and alcoholism and alcohol abuse, COPD, depression, fetal death, health-related quality of life, illicit drug use, heart disease, liver disease, risk of intimate partner violence, multiple sexual partners, STDs, smoking, and the list goes on of these adverse health outcomes that are actually related to the amount of adversity that you may have had in childhood. So as ACE scores increase, this is a very interesting study, and just to highlight a couple of points, it says ACEs increase, you know, there's this dose response between the number of ACEs you have and these things. So 1 in 69 people with an ACE score of 0 are alcoholic, but 1 in 6 are alcoholics when their ACE score is 7 or more. So you can see that across the second line there, you have 0 ACEs, 1 in 69 is an alcoholic, but then you get over there to a person that has a history of 7 or more ACEs, their 1 in 6 is alcoholic. 1 out of 480 people with 0 ACEs uses IV drugs, compared to 1 out of 30 with a score of an ACE score of 7 or more. So the more adversity you have in your childhood, the more ACE, the higher your ACE score, the more likely you are to be an IV drug user. People with high ACEs are twice as likely to be smokers, 12 times more likely to have committed suicide or attempted suicide, 7 times more likely to be alcoholic, and 10 times more likely to have injected street drugs. People with high ACE scores are more likely to be violent, have more marriages, more broken bones, more drug prescriptions, more depression, more autoimmune diseases, and more work absences. So you can see that, you know, as we learn what sets the stage for a person's life happens in childhood, and if you have this adversity, it sort of it lays a path for what might happen to you over the course of your lifetime. So what happens with the brain under stress? And this is something that we're really learning a lot about. And we're going to talk just a little bit about the intermediate, or the immediate, intermediate, and long-term consequences. So this is a bear, and I love when I hear Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, pediatrician, who's a national spokesperson on ACEs, talking about this. And she tells a story about the bear. You know, she pounds her chest and says, you know, if you're in the forest and you see a bear, what happens? You go into fight or flight. That's good. That's good that our brain activates that way. You know, your heart starts to pump, your eyes dilate, your skin gets cool. I mean, all these things that happen because of what happens in the brain. And here, if you want to, the more brain function, I'm not going to go through that right now. But it's great if you're in the forest and it's a bear. But many children grow up with bears in their home. And the bears in their home might be an alcoholic parent coming home, or a drug use in the home, where the child is feeling fearful and afraid, and that affects the child and the child's brain development, and ultimately could have an impact on the rest of their life. So we don't want our children to be, you know, in homes with bears, but many of them are. And so what we're, you know, there's also the feature that we want to talk about is how do we build resilience? If you're a child and you've grown up in a home where there's a bear, how do you build that resilience to overcome some of these negative impacts that have occurred in your brain and in your body, your immune system, your neurologic system? Because this stress affects all the systems in your body. So we talked about the bear lives in the home. So also, if that bear lives in the home, you know, when you go to school, let's say the child has been up the night before with the parents fighting and the child being afraid and hiding, and then they go to school the next day. Do you think they're ready to learn? No. They can't learn. They're stressed. They get in trouble at school. One of the things that we're learning is, many of you have heard Cindy talking and us talking about the sound discipline training that's been going on here in Clark County about, and what we learned from Paper Tigers, how to deal with teaching kids differently, how to discipline differently, and trying to understand maybe what's going on in that child's life. So the a child with trauma in the background, you can see the developmental trauma. Everything is upside down. Instead of focusing survival being a tiny part of a child's life, it becomes the focus of their life. And in a typical development, the thinking part, the social-emotional development and the cognition, those should be higher order and more take more of the child's growth and development time. But if the child is living with a survival mode, it impacts their ability to self-regulate. They don't have strong social-emotional, and they don't think well. They don't have good cognition skills. And I think the thing that's hardest about ACEs that we sometimes make the assumption that behavior is something that we totally control, but behavior may not be a choice. May not be that we can decide. If that child is coming from a situation where they're being traumatized in the home, their acting out at school is their way of coping with that stress that they're dealing with. And they're in a fight or a flight mode. The one of those moods is, or those modes is affecting them because of what's going on in their brain. So the natural reaction for traumatized children is survival, and that's what they focus on. And so they sometimes may not be the most compliant student at school. They may act out. And so if we work with our teachers in our education system about different kinds of approaches, we can help those children build resilience and be able to be more successful in school and ultimately maybe have fewer of the consequences of ACEs. So intermediate trauma impact, where this goes on, affects the brain development. And we have solid evidence about how the brain is impacted by adversity in childhood. The impact of maltreatment, depends on the age of the child, the gender, the type of abuse, the frequency and duration, who the abuser is that's hurting the child, and whether or not that child has access to a caring adult. That's one of the things that we've learned about building resilience in children and adults who have a history of ACEs is the thing that can impact them the most is a caring adult in their life. Long term, this is the part that I find the scariest about everything we're learning about ACEs and resilience is that the impact of that childhood trauma is inheritable through a field of science called epigenetics. And for those of you that are of scientific minds, there are three different models of how this is happening, how this inherited traits are going on. And I'm not going to go into those right now, but those are the three models of that are being talked about. So, and I know Sandy's going to be talking about what's going on with youth suicide and give some Washington statistics, but in Washington State, we know that 12% of our elementary kids have three or more ACEs. 42% of high school students have three or more ACEs. So you just think about the impact that that has on them for their ability to be successful in school. And in an average Washington State high school classroom, 7 students will have 4 to 5 ACEs, and 3 students will have 6 or more ACEs. So you can just imagine, and the teacher has to have the strategies to know how to deal with where these kids' brains are, so to help effectively help them learn and to manage their behavior in the classroom. So one of the studies, one of the people that we've actually had come and talk with us in the past here on the FAC was Dr. Clay Mosier from WSU, who has been looking at the characteristics and studying the truant population here in Clark County. And so if you can look at the number, compare our truants that are being managed through juvenile justice with the Kaiser study, you can see that 4 or more ACEs in the Kaiser study was about 12%. And in our truant population, it's up to upwards of 50%. So this is work that Clay Mosier is doing, understanding, what's contributing to these young people becoming truant and then being getting involved in the juvenile justice system. This is my favorite slide of the whole presentation, and it's what's now being called the pair of ACEs, where you have the 10 adverse childhood experiences, but they're grounded on what's going on in the community, what we're calling adverse community environments. Things like poverty, discrimination, community disruption, lack of opportunity, economic mobility, and social capital, poor housing quality and affordability, which is a very big issue here in our community, families living in cars or in tents, and then violence. So this is sort of a picture that I think should set the stage for everybody. So we've heard all the terrible things about ACEs, you know, but the world, there's hope. Having ACEs, the first thing that we all can do is be aware of what's going on in our own lives, and maybe be aware of what were the things that helped an individual build resilience. So an ACE score, so what does it mean if you do the ACE self-test? It's just answering 10 questions and you find out what your score is. It's a way to communicate without details. If you're ever in a situation and you're screening about ACEs, nobody wants to know what those ACEs were. It's just that it's the score that matters, whether you had two ACEs or one ACE or five ACEs. So an ACE score is a way to communicate without having to go into the details. It's a common language that's now being used in healthcare and in schools and in education and in social service agencies, and it's really changing the way we think about how to help people. It's a key to information, and it's really a door to understanding compassion and treatment. It's not a quiz, it's not a diagnosis, it's not a prognosis or prediction, it's not a life sentence. If anybody in this room would do the ACE score and find out, oh my goodness, I have ACE score of 7, it's just being aware of that and then figuring out, okay, what does this mean for me, and what is it that's helped me get to this point in my life? Maybe I still need help. So what we're concerned about now in our community, and it all started here at this council several years ago when we said our big concern was, we said about 2 years ago that our big concern in the community was adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. And so when that happened, there were several of us that got together, Cindy, myself, some people from the ESD, and we started the ACEs Action Alliance, which is now a coalition in Clark County of about 60 organizations and over 200 people working to build resilience in our community. And one of the things that's about building resilience that's really important, if there's one message that you will go away with tonight, it's to ask, you know, in the world of building resilience, if you have a child that's acting up or if you have an adult that's having issues, instead of sort of focusing with that, what's wrong with you, think about a different thing. What happened to you? Really help people understand what happened to them that causes them to have certain kinds of behaviors and health issues. And so this is a very important question that especially we in healthcare are beginning to build into screening. So what the literature and what we've learned is that every child who winds up doing well has had at least one stable and committed relationship with a supportive adult. Sometimes this may not be the parent. The parent may love the child, but the parent may not have the capacity to provide nurturing and loving support, maybe because they're trying to make a living, maybe because they themselves have issues. And it could be somebody at school, it could be a teacher, it could be a lunchroom lady, it could be a neighbor, and it's why mentoring programs are such a powerful program. At our last ACEs Action Alliance meeting, we had a whole panel of some of the different mentoring programs available in Clark County. And let me tell you, we have a lot of mentoring programs. And we're working on, the mentoring group is working on a guide so that we know how to refer people to mentors, especially young people to mentors. So the keys to, these are the three keys to resilience: attachment and belonging, capability, and community, and the community, culture, and faith, that there be a supportive community. And so this is what our ACEs Action Alliance is trying to work with, increasing the awareness in our community of ACEs, and then helping groups and organizations know what they can do to be help promote resiliency in their population. It's a complex slide, but if you want to study it later, you'll see that these are the kinds of adverse childhood experiences and the kinds of protective factors that go on that we could build in our community. Making sure every child, for example, has good early learning and good child care. We have compassionate schools. We have restorative justice programs. So we do have a lot of these things in our community, but it's this kind of situation where we can develop further. So our Action Alliance, which was established as a result of this group identifying ACEs as a problem, Our mission is to align community efforts to promote resilience in Clark County. And currently we have 5 action teams. We have an assessment and evaluation team that's looking at data so that we could actually measure whether we are making progress about increasing resilience in the community. We have a trauma-informed organizations team, which is working on working with organizations to help them do a self-assessment about whether they are trauma-informed. We have a community outreach team, which is working on education and awareness and trying to make sure all the different sectors of our community are educated and informed about ACEs. We have a trauma-informed schools teams. Many of our schools have really jumped right on board with this, and so we have a newer group on school-informed teams. And then we have a clinical intervention team trying to reach out to our pediatric and primary care practices to make sure they're doing screening and that they know the resources available in the community if they identify a child who has a high ACE score. So these are some of the things that could go on, training and clinics, making sure, for example, making sure ACEs is discussed in curriculums of healthcare care professionals and social workers and teachers, you know, all the people that are touching kids, making sure that they have that training. And we've trained in the community, we've done training with the early childhood educators, and you're going to hear a lot about what's going on out in Battleground. We're really focusing on the trauma-informed schools. And then again, what's going on in the juvenile justice system and what's going on in our Safe Communities Task Force and our Gang Prevention Task Force and law enforcement, what's going on in law enforcement. They're a critical partnership in building resilience in our community. So in our what we've learned from some community conversations we had about the showing of the films or the documentary Raising of America, just some things for you to be aware of. 1 in 7 children under the age of 5 in our community lives in poverty. 6 of every 1,000 children live in foster care. Each of these things are settings in which that child could develop a high ACE score. 1/3 of Clark County children 0 to 5 live with a single parent, which might limit that single parent's ability and resources. Only 42% of our county's children have the foundational skills, knowledge, and abilities needed to succeed in kindergarten. And this is the data that was in the State of Our Children report that I talked about the meeting before last. A lot of this data is coming from that. But this is part of what's going on in our community, the conversations that's being promoted and pushed by our ACEs Action Alliance. So there's a long list of ideas of what we could do to improve the environment in our community to support children. I'm not going to go through these. You can see there's just a wealth of ideas there. So the thing about ACEs is that it's us as adults that can address the issues that happen to our children in our community. And our children can't, you know, in our self group, one of our local groups that's involved in early learning, we have a campaign called Our Children Can't Wait. And, you know, just think about 6,000 babies born in Clark County every year. And what can we do to make sure every one of those 6,000 babies is ready for kindergarten and has a healthy childhood and gets the benefit of what we know in the world of science is good for kids. So, boy, I sped through that because I promised Rob that I'd get done. I think I did it, didn't I?
We did awesome. It was great.
So, next. And we have some questions later, so.
John, did you want to go ahead and talk about the upcoming?
Okay. One of the things that's going on is, and again, it's one of these events, it's in your packet. On Monday, our ACEs Alliance meeting is actually, we are showing the documentary called Resilience. It's a fabulous documentary. And it's all about the biology of stress and the science of hope. It's about ACEs and resilience. And we're having a guest speaker, Jim Sporletter, who is the principal, or the now retired principal from the Lincoln High School in Walla Walla, where the film Paper Tigers was made. So he's going to be the guest speaker at that meeting on Monday. If you are interested in coming, you must register. And right now, we have a limited capacity. So if you're interested in attending, you need to go home tonight and register at the browser at the bottom of the sheet. It's the place that you go and put in a registration. And we may have to have a wait list. But this is just one of the programs that's going on. And you're all invited to our ACES Alliance meetings. They're held once a month. We're taking a summer break, so we won't have a meeting again until September. But we'll let you know when our meeting is in September. And come and join the 200 people who are on our mailing list. We don't have 200 people at meeting. People come to. But we have a core group of many people who come to every meeting, but people that are on our mailing list. And there's lots going on in the community. Lots going on in the community about this. So thank you. So, Sandy.
Okay, so I'm going to switch into teaching mode. So I want you all to stand up, please. Will you grab a partner? And if you need to, we're going to move around for about 30 seconds. So come in the middle of the room. You're going to need to move. So grab a partner. Anybody's fine. And you have like 10 seconds to do that. So get a partner. And you're going to need to move during the next exercise. When we teach children and we teach adults, we know that if you sit too long, you're not going to be able to listen. And you need to move around and be active. So is everybody ready to be active? Okay, the directions are this. You cannot speak. You can only use your body to move. And I'm going to give you directions. And with your partner, who's your partner? I want you to demonstrate to your partner these activities. You ready? First one is basketball. Go. Next one's volleyball. You're going to do hopscotch. You're surfing. Show me surfing. Disco dancing. Come on. Disco dancing. Let me see it. Hopscotch. Now we're going to do that. Waltz. Do waltz. You're painting a picture. Paint a picture. Your partner's on fire. You're on fire. Do the hokey pokey. Thank you. Sit down. I like that icebreaker. It never ceases to make people laugh. So for the next few minutes, thank you, Joan. You're just going to think that we planned this, but we didn't. Maybe we shouldn't say that. But I'm going to talk to you about, I want you to imagine the information you just got about ACES, and I want you to imagine sitting in a room 3 years ago, and you have the opportunity to apply for federal funding at $10.2 million. And you can pick a school district, and in this case, you can pick three in the state. And we know from Health Use Survey data that the three districts we have to pick have high need. And they do. But they're not that different from any other district in the state. So we did that. We picked three districts. One of those districts is Battle Ground School District. And Project Aware funding was given by President Obama in response to the Sandy Hook disaster. And the president said, what we want you to do is do three things in this grant funding. We want you to improve school climate and safety. We want you to increase access to mental health services and to provide those services if possible. And we want you to improve the awareness of mental health issues with students and their parents in your districts and community. And underneath those three goals, you can see here, now think back, what did Joan tell you about ACES? She said that kids need a caring adult. They need to not, that alcohol and drug use is one of the problems that happens, that kids who don't have access to mental health care. So we really were thinking upstream about how do we work with kids, because we now know, we have more evidence than ever, and I'm going to talk about that, that ACEs is really what I call an invisible epidemic. That children who are coming and sitting in schools every day have tremendous issues. And that is systemic, and it's been going on for a while. But in schools now, we're seeing the evidence of that, and I'm going to talk to you about that today. So when we designed this Project Aware grant, we said we're going to do a few things. We're going to put in, and I'll talk about this too in a minute, but positive behaviors, interventions, and supports is a framework that school districts use. And basically what it says is teach all children, all kids, how to behave. Teach them what you expect in the lunchroom, in the classroom, in the hallway, in the recess. Make it five simple rules, and then catch them doing it the way you want them to, and reinforce them for doing that. And then what we know is about 80% of students in a building, a classroom, a hallway, or a recess area will do what you expect them to do, especially if you reinforce them for doing what you expected. And about 20% of those children won't respond to that, and they'll need additional support. And we call that tier two. And kids in tier two need specific additional instruction on how to do the social emotional skills that they don't come to school with, or that they need additional supports on. So think about kids who we teach to read. We teach them to read in a classroom. If they need additional support, we put them in small groups and give them an instruction that is very specific to what their needs are and gaps. So that's what we do around behavior and social emotional learning is we provide support groups for kids who demonstrate to their behavior, usually through discipline, that they're not getting the picture, and we give them more supports. Then tier three of this thing called PBIS is the top 2 to 5% of any given population in any building that is dramatically affected by whatever is happening to them, and they need therapeutic services. Okay, 2 to 5%. Now the problem in schools that don't have a framework like this is that if they don't teach kids what to expect, reinforce them for doing it, and then provide tier two services, which are supports, a lot of kids are identified as needing therapeutic services when they really don't. Okay, so we really set that up. Then we did we collect school-wide information. It's called a program called SQUIS, and it's just a way for us to tell how is it that we're doing around teaching kids what we expect, and that information system is the referral system that teachers use, and we've had to adapt that, work on it, trust me. If you ever want to make educators angry, take away the ability for them to write a referral for gum chewing or hat wearing. And PE non-suits is my favorite. So think about children who go to PE and don't suit down. Why aren't they doing that? They have wounds on their body they want you to see. They don't have the resources to have the PE clothes. They don't have the cool shoes that they need. Doesn't matter. Lots and lots of referrals written for PE non-suits, and then you get detention and get suspended. How many think that's wrong? I don't know. Okay, so we worked on that. And then we put student assistance program or prevention intervention specialists in all of our middle schools and high schools, and those are people whose sole job on earth is to provide tier two services, support groups for kids who need additional supports in social emotional learning, and to be the key adult who connects with children who don't have somebody else to connect to, because we know it's the single greatest way to change outcomes for children. And those PIs, or prevention intervention specialists, are in every middle school and high school, and sometimes two of them at high schools in Battleground. And we do a school climate survey. And then below that, you can see their objectives are decrease alcohol use, decrease marijuana use, decrease bullying, increase school climate, and reduce suspensions and expulsions. Makes sense, right? If we do that, we're hopeful that upstream, we're creating environments in children who don't have ACEs, that they use less drugs, they use, right? Okay, all right. So the second category there is increased access to mental health services, and I'm gonna talk a lot about that today. We developed a referral system for mental health. We work with our community providers because schools are not experts on providing therapeutic services at all. We provide education. That means teaching children to read and do mathematics. So we have memorandums of understanding with community providers in our community, and mental health therapists are given free space and access in our buildings, and we have them in every building in Battleground for at least one day a week. And those children who need the services are referred into them. Okay? And instead of hiring our own, we wanted to use our providers because we think they're really key community partners. Deliver mental health services, provide training, engage parents and network partners. Finally, we have a thing called Youth Mental Health First Aid Training, and that is, if you think about CPR training, we teach adults in our community how to intervene with kids if they're worried about them. Okay? So I'm gonna show you some of the things that have happened as a result of this. Those are those objectives again. This is over a 3-year process. We got this grant 3 years ago. And what you're gonna see on these objectives is the declines in things like alcohol use. And we used the Healthy Youth Survey to measure this, and that's every kid in 6, 8, 10, and 12. So look at those declines. Yeah, those are great, right? We have seen a 36% decline in 8th grade and 30% decline in 10th graders using alcohol. Same thing with marijuana. Because we've been very intentional about the instruction for kids, support for kids, tier two, remember, we're giving them support groups, we're talking to them. Okay. Then bullying, remember that? We wanted to see reductions in bullying. We're seeing tremendous decreases in bullying because we're creating a system that really supports decreases in bullying in my buildings. And then we ask kids all the time, but we want to see increases in feeling safe in school, right? Everybody needs to feel safe in the building. And what we see here is, now it's really hard to move a bar from 86%, But we do see, as you can see there, the trending is going upwards, and that's really good too. Kids feel very, very safe in our buildings, for the most part. Okay, so then increased access to mental health services. Let's talk about that. First, I'm gonna talk to you about what made us choose this and what's going on. So we know that this is the Health Use Survey, and we know that children in Battleground, the blue bar is Battleground kids, the other bar is state. What do you notice about the Battleground children in this slide?
They're very similar.
Very similar, or at or below the state average, right? So we don't have, what I've talked to Alan about this a few times is, Battleground's not unique. There's not huge amounts of problems that other students in the state have, but we do have them. 24% of 8th graders, 30% of sophomores, and almost 33% of our 12th graders say they feel depressed. Let's look at this. What's happened in AWARE? So remember all those other outcomes? Great outcomes. We've been doing tremendous work in this district, the support of our superintendent board. And what we see here is in 8th grade, that depressive feelings have gone down. Remember I told you those prevention intervention specialists at all the middle schools? But look at what happens to sophomores in this study. With all those other outcomes, what's happening with sophomores?
No change.
In fact, look what's happened to our oldest children. They're getting more depressed. It is not changing. So when everything else in a grant like this and a system is changing, but this variable isn't, it makes you wonder, what's going on? Why are kids continuing to grow in their depression? Or what, most importantly for me as adults in this community, are we doing about this outcome? Okay, contemplation of suicide. What do you notice about Battleground versus the state? Very similar, right? In fact, below the state averages in every one of those. What do you notice about 20% of seniors who say that they've contemplated suicide? Out of 100 children, how many is that?
20.
So if we have 500 seniors, do the math for a second.
500 of them have contemplated suicide.
Okay. How many have made a plan? Here's Battleground's data. And what do you notice about the drops there? Significant drops, right? We have had 6 completed suicides in Battleground in the 21 months that I have worked there. So it is imperative that the adults in this community, not just Battleground, this isn't just Battleground, it's just the data that I've got and where I work right now, understand that this is not going away. It's happening all over the county, and it's with our children. And we are doing everything we can in this district to reduce that number. And by all accounts, these outcomes are amazing. We're really doing what we said we would do. I know all their names. I've met with their parents. How about children telling us that they have a supportive adult? When you feel sad or helpless, are there adults you can turn to? And this is the percentage of kids who write, no or not sure. It's gone down. It's a tremendous outcome. So what do you do? That's why I come to these meetings, I raise my hand and I say, what are we gonna do? Because all of the outcomes we're trying to achieve in this community that I work in are going the right directions. And we still keep losing children. I don't think we're alone in this. I just think the awareness is really high, and I work there. Our kids tell us they're above the state average, and I have an adult I can talk to. Doing pretty well there. Now, remember what Don told you about ACEs, right? So let me bring you back to that average classroom in Washington State. This is put out by the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Every child that's represented in this with purple means that their A score is above 3, right? Okay, so it's an invisible epidemic in schools. We know that in every average classroom, that's what's going on. Why are kids this way? Because this is what the conditions are in schools. Okay,
I'm kind of being a downer, but I really want people to understand this. So we're trying to build supportive and safe schools one brick at a time. What do I mean by that? That triangle right there is that PBIS work we're doing, and that's our foundation. So think of a brick house. Think of a house that we're building. The foundation is teach all kids how to behave and catch them doing good at it. Give them supportive adults to talk to and be fair and kind about your stuff and do restorative practices with them when they get in trouble. Ask them what's going on with them instead of what's wrong with them. Then what we're doing too is the bricks in our house, think of little bricks in a house, right? The bricks are, we're putting providers in. We have memorandums of understanding with all of our providers. Therapists are highly skilled, that's quality of care. We have master's level therapists in every building. And Medicaid funding is available for most, but not all. The mortar, what keeps the bricks together in this building? What keeps the bricks, that is, what do we need to sustain all of this as we go forward? Mortar funding is what I call the glue that keeps it together that we're currently paying for out of AWARE funds. And that is, we pay for undocumented youth. We pay for kids whose parents have ridiculous co-pays. I couldn't figure another way to say that. So that's all I'm going to say about that, is that they have insurance, but they don't, because the co-pay is so large that their families would never get health care. We're paying for that. We are also, students who are 13 years or older in this state can seek and receive help. They can do that without their parents' permission. That's a lie. They really can. If you are going to bill anybody for anything, you have to send stuff home to parents. Who are the vulnerable populations of children who might need to seek and receive care without their parents knowing? Anybody? Any ideas?
Those who are abused.
Kids who are abused. LGBTQ kids in a very conservative community, say like, I don't know, Battleground. Who else might be represented in this mortar funding that we simply cannot get funding for?
Well, children that come from affluent families that wouldn't want anyone in their community to know that their child had a problem.
Okay.
Because if the child has a problem, the parent could possibly have a problem.
Yeah. The other thing that this mortar funding, what I call mortar funding, is paying for and aware right now, is necessary meeting time that Medicaid funders can't bill for, grant paperwork. We're keeping track of all of this, and travel time for very rural starts. And what sites in our community, because if you go clear out to Amboy, you have to, you know, people, anyway, it's what's happening. We are the payer of last, so we try as hard as possible to work with our providers to build everything we can. Everyone's doing that. But the AWARE grant right now is paying for this funding that nobody else can capture, and we have those services in every building in our community. How's it worked? We partnered with 112. They're the experts. They have a mental health coordinator, and he's going to talk a little bit about what she does. But we call the request for proposals out to the community. Our mental health providers were selected. MOUs were completed. All buildings except our alternative buildings, and I can talk about that. But they have, every single building has a mental health provider on site that offers therapeutic services. We created this whole system, point of contact system, with our building counselors who refer families, and it's a soft handoff. They call home, families come in. Super important. We've had 453 students referred to therapeutic services since September. That's about 4% of our population. Remember the triangle I gave you? 2-5% of kids need intensive services. There you go. It's right there. 435 children and their families. And I could stand all day and tell you about those kids, but we don't have that time. What's happening now? How do we sustain the services after grant funding is ending? The grant was supposed to be for 5 years. This is the third year. The federal government has told us that we will lose the carryover funds we have to the tune of about $330,000 in the next 3 months. If we don't spend it all, we're going to lose it. We think on October 1, we'll get another year of funding. We don't know that. And after this, it's gone. So all that mortar funding I was talking about will not stay here. We don't have it anymore. So what are we doing to talk about this? We thought we had 5 years to plan, but we don't. So we're working with our provider to see where cuts can be made if they can. But I'm gonna tell you right now that I'm very serious about not spending money in ways that we don't need to. And then we're working with our community to explore local resources. Bob and I were at the city council last week, and we're really talking about it. Because in my opinion, the only thing worse than setting all of this up and providing mental health services to children in buildings who really, really, really need it, is then having it go away. There is, and we've talked about this a little bit, but there's a 0.1% tax that was passed in this county a number of years ago, specifically to augment funding for mental health and chemical dependency services and provide outcomes that may include reducing the burden of mental health and chemical dependency on other systems. I would challenge folks, and I plan to continue, to say, where's that money going? And why wouldn't our county make it a priority to use that funding, at least some of it, is that, I don't know how much it is, but at least some of it, to continue to provide that mortar funding that I talked about earlier, because this system in one district is already set. Providers are there, the referrals are happening, and 435 children have received those services. This is just one district, but it was meant to be replicable, to be shared with other districts across the state and region, and to show them how we did it. That's the whole reason they gave you the funding. Okay? Anyway, that's it. That's what I do. Okay.
Who's next? Yeah,
Wendy. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Wendy Silverthorne, and I'm the SMART team coordinator. I don't have a PowerPoint for you. I just have a few minutes to share with you. SMART team is the School Mobilization Assistance Response Teams. We operate under a memorandum of understanding from all the superintendents in Clark County. We train SMART team volunteers, they're all, or almost all of them are school employees, to respond to basically tragedies that happen in our community where students need emotional support. I usually talk to Sandy late at night or on the weekends because that's when most of our calls come in. I think these last two school years I've had one call come in during the work day. I do this half-time and then I have another half-time position I combine it with. I'm a drug-free communities coordinator for a coalition, and we were writing our grant this year and submitted it on March 15th. And after that, we'd already had quite a few calls this year, but since I got that grant submitted, we've had an average of one call a week. The majority of those have been suicides, and it's felt very heavy this year. So it's a horrible situation to be dealing with, and I look around our community and people, I've been doing this work for about 16 years, and people know me and they call me, and I sort of represent this issue to a lot of people in the community. So on June 6th, I scheduled a community forum to talk about youth suicide for our whole community. I invited all the school districts and coalitions in Clark County to attend. I put together an expert panel that included Mary Jadwiziak, the youth suicide prevention specialist, who spoke about signs and symptoms. And then next was Christina Patton, who's a nurse practitioner with both Catholic Social Services and the Vancouver Clinic. Our third speaker was Lisa Westland from the Clark County Crisis Line. And our fourth speaker was Pat Beckett, who is director of the Children's Center, to talk about resources. And then I told the audience that the tough part was going to be limiting questions and discussion to half hour, and indeed it was. I want to step back for a moment and say that listening to all these comments I get from the community and dealing with school counselors and school administrators, part of what motivated me to convene this forum was sometimes I hear comments that indicate people feel like this is a school problem and that schools need to fix it. And I'm really clear, it's not a school problem and schools can't fix it. It needs to be the whole community. No one segment of our community can fix what I think is a big community problem. And the other concern I have is, although Sandy spoke very eloquently about depression, I'm amazed how little I hear about depression and mental health issues when this comes up. And I'm a clinical social worker, and that's particularly frustrating to me because depression is treatable in most cases. So I want the community to have that message, which is why I put together that great panel. I'm very pleased to tell you we had over 150 people show up. I put this forum together in less than 3 weeks, so that was wonderful. And I think our community is really concerned, and the time is really ripe to do something. So it was very fortuitous that Roxanne called me and asked me to come this evening and share about the forum, because I've been meaning to call the Department of Health. One thing that concerns me is that we don't have a child death review team in our county, and I think it's time to put one together and to look at what the common factors are and what we can do differently. And then really the last thing I have to say about this is I can't do this by myself. I need help from the community, and I'm hoping that the Department of Health can support these efforts and take them forward. I'm happy to be a part of it. I'm happy to help put meetings together. I'm pretty good at that, but I can't do it all by myself either. That's basically what I have to say this evening.
Can I get a laptop? Okay, so at first I'd like to apologize. I woke up yesterday with a fever, so I'm not feeling that great. But I wanted to come in and give this presentation because I think it's pretty important. So just a quick disclaimer. I was invited to do this presentation at the beginning of last week, which also happened to be finals week. So this is a little, I wish I could have been more in depth, but I'd love to follow up on this if possible with better information. And then when I asked my peers if they could come in and help me, they were like, Amy, it's finals week, I can't do that. So I'm presenting this on my own. However, I was able to get the input of peers through a little survey that I sent out. So I'm presenting my opinion mixed along with input from peers representing Washougal, Union, Thomas Jefferson, Clark College, Fort Vancouver, iTech, Prairie, La Center, Jesuit, and Columbia River. So based on that, please do not take this as something official. This is nothing to build policy on. This is my personal opinion mixed with that of the youth that are around me. So I made this to sort of start conversation and spur, you know, thinking about this topic. So please do not take this as anything too concrete. All right, so this is a questionnaire that I made. I didn't include all of it because I wanted to make this kind of more concise, but I did include a couple of things. So these are some things to keep in mind when you're considering the youth suicide. So these are things that people send in to me as things that they would want adults to know when they're considering what to do about youth suicide. So be aware that youth could be suicidal without showing any signs. You never know what someone is going through. It's very true. People have things happening in their lives that you have no idea. I personally lost a friend that, you know, you just didn't know, you could not tell. So I know firsthand that that's very important. And as adults, as you are, it is very important to show youth that you're not just an adult, so to say. You need to talk with them instead of at them as a friend. And don't assume that they already have someone to talk to or anything like that. You know, you need to be that person for them because they may not have anyone else to talk to. Know the signs, know what depression looks like, and know how to approach people that may be showing the signs. Make sure to talk about the positives and push individual importance. make sure that the youth know that they are enough. They are important and that they matter and all that, that stuff. They need to know that. And instead of telling troubled youth reasons that other people want them to live, like, that's selfish, you know, don't kill yourself, that's selfish, think about the people around you. Instead of saying things like that, tell them reasons that will make them want to live for themselves. That's often more effective. You want to live for yourself, not for other people. So, and then most teens that are truly struggling with depression have difficulty speaking up. It's a hard thing to talk about. Adults need to create these ways that youth can speak up. They need to be easy ways. You can't, it can't be some sort of labyrinth. They need to be able to know where to go and what to do in this sort of situation when they're feeling this way. And doing something is always better than doing nothing. Even if you're not sure that this is the right thing to do, doing something is more important than being a standby person, I guess, and not doing anything. And then youth are complex beings. We have a lot going on in our lives. We are kind of emotional roller coasters, and we need to be respected. You know, our feelings, although there may be a lot of them, they're valid. So we need to be respected, and that must be handled accordingly. So when I asked about programs that my peers knew about in their school or in Clark County, many of them didn't know any. They said, I don't know, not applicable. I think that's a problem. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to know these resources. So I think that we need to work on promoting them around the community more. We need to put up posters and places and that sort of thing to let them know that there are ways to get help. One of the things that was mentioned quite a bit, though, was Teen Talk. And for those of you that don't know what that is, Teen Talk is a peer-to-peer warm line as compared to a hotline. So it's not like a crisis line, but it's, you know, a place to talk to someone. And what it is you can call and talk to a person your age about relationships, family and friends, school, sports, sexual orientation, that sort of thing. And it's just a way to talk to someone to get stuff off your chest. And I personally used it before. It's very, very helpful. And that was one of the things that was mentioned a lot. And then many youth also commented on feeling as though their schools haven't stepped up. Especially when a suicide has happened, they said they didn't feel like the school did anything to help the students. And, you know, I'm no expert on this. I don't know what to do to fix that, but I think that that's important, that these people are saying, hey, we didn't think our school did anything to help. So I think that because these people are saying that, we need to do something about that. I'm not quite sure what, but I think that's very important. All right, so kind of the bigger picture of this. So this was kind of an interesting topic that I thought about. So peer-to-peer intervention. Communicating with and engaging youth should not be misconstrued as a call for direct peer-to-peer intervention. So if you think about it, youth brains are not in the right state to be handling the lives of their peers. The same brains that are capable of committing suicide should not be held responsible to keep their friends alive, so to speak. That's a little intense, but it's true. And it's just, it's too much. It's too intense. And we don't think that leaving this intervention up to peers is the right choice. We want to be heard. We want to be asked questions about youth suicide, but we don't want to be held responsible. We don't want that responsibility on our shoulders. And then an example of this would be you guys heard of See Something, Say Something? That slogan's used for quite a few things, but one of them is gun violence. And that's something that's told to kids, you know, if you see something, say something. That's not teaching kids what to do. You know, if they see a person with a gun, they're not teaching them to go up and tackle the person or whatever. It's just telling them, go say something to someone else. It's not telling them to directly attack the issue. So like that, we want to not directly involve other youth in the prevention, but we still want to have their opinions and such. So how can we engage youth in healthy ways without kind of throwing the responsibility on them? So organizations have a tendency to see established practices that have been done in other communities and become compelled to implement it locally. And often they don't consult the youth about that. Sure, it could look promising in another place, but it may not be of interest to young people. Making sure that decisions are not being made over the heads of youth is very important. And, same thing, information should be collected from the affected parties. So you wouldn't paint a portrait at someone without looking at them, or you wouldn't give someone medication without knowing their illness. It's So kind of far stretches, but it's like that. You need to collect information from the affected party, which in this case is the youth. And creating spaces where youth feel safe to share their thoughts and ideas is very important. To get our voices out there, some standardized testing does exist as a form of screening in some schools, which is, like I said before, you know, doing something is better than doing nothing. But the answers are limited. You can't express what you really want to say. And I think that, you know, these generic questions may not be the best approach to getting the opinions of the youth. And yeah, it doesn't have to be complicated. Simplicity might be a better option. Just, you know, being there for them to talk to you. It doesn't have to be some sort of program. It can just be, you know, standing up and saying, hey, I'm here to listen to you, to get opinions out. It could just be teachers asking students, parents asking children, that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be anything special. And then youth on boards, like what I'm doing here right now, getting voices, youth voices out there, putting them on boards is one good way to do that. And then this is another point that I wanted to make, is promoting positivity. So instead of promoting what we don't want to see, which are youth suicides, you know, this is a big topic of tonight, youth suicide. Instead of constantly focusing on the negatives, we should focus on what we want to see more of, so the positive side of things. If we're building structures and programs, you know, founded on concepts of self-appreciation and acceptance, if you are amazing, if you go to college, don't go to college, or in this or that social group, et cetera, that sort of thing. You know, building connections between staff and students, strengthening that bond can be really, really important in keeping youth alive and giving them people to go to. And so, yeah, it's still a very important topic to discuss. I'm not saying throw it under the rug, forget about it, but focusing on the positives from the very beginning could stop youth suicides down the road. An example of this is there was a recent newsletter from Camus, which I actually thought was very enlightening. And one of the quotes from that newsletter was, "We wanted students to know how much we appreciated them, were proud of them, and valued their thoughts." And I wish I brought the newsletter with me, but it was very, they interviewed students, and they talked to students about how they were feeling, what they felt about their schools, you know, what they wanted to change. And yeah, they got feedback from about 500 students on engaging with their staff, you know, how they feel the staff were doing, what connections were they making, and that sort of thing. And I thought that was, it was cool to see some of that stuff actually happening. And yeah, in general, just spreading kindness and compassion can make youth feel like they matter. So I think that's about it. Some takeaways, kind of to summarize. Youth suicide is a very, very real problem. And in order to attempt to solve it, we must be involved, but not held responsible for the suicides of others. So there are healthy, simple ways to engage youth in prevention without throwing it at them. And then promoting positivity, instead of entirely focusing on negatives, is a good way to stop thoughts of suicide before they begin. And I did speak to, I don't know if any of you guys know Chris Henriksen. She runs Teen Talk. Yeah. And I spoke to her about some of these things, and I have her contact information if any of you would like more information from her. So yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Can I get a copy of that presentation?
Mm-hmm. In the notes. So all the presentations we've presented tonight will be in part of the notes that are coming
out. Sandy's as well.
Yep.
So I just wanted to open up for any questions for our presenters.
Mm-hmm. I did have something to say about Kit. Chris, I'm sorry, is offering a youth mental health first aid in September. Mm-hmm. And if you contact him and let him know that you're interested, you can be a part of that training. It's a day-long training, but it's a very good training.
September?
Mm-hmm.
Can we reach out to you and get some additional information on that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. That's that positive, the Prevention Awareness Month. And NAMI, Southwest Washington, we have a Suicide Prevention Awareness Committee meeting that we're trying to get things together for that month, so I'll bring in other information to you about things going on in the community.
I had a question for, I think it's Sandy. Mm-hmm. So for the suicides that have occurred recently in Battleground, do you find that, you know, some of those had actually been referred to your mental health prior, or were these all, I was just wondering, like, if you were able to capture, if you had found a way to capture them before?
So I didn't talk about it tonight, but I could have. In our district, we've made a huge effort to put in a suicide prevention policy and to use, there's forms and ways that we're working with every student in the district who presents to counselors or psychs or social workers a certain way, and then we do a process. We have not, this year we've been piloting that, we haven't been collecting the data back on that, so I don't actually have that information.
Okay.
That's a really good question too. One of the youth who died by suicide in our district was there. One of the youth who died by suicide had just recently graduated, mm-hmm. and another youth had died by suicide and just, he and his family had experienced a great deal of problems, mm-hmm. and so he had just transferred out of our district into another mm-hmm. district. So some of what happens with the kids who are as vulnerable as the ones we're talking about is there's a lot of stuff that goes on and they're hard to track.
Mm-hmm.
But next year it's our intention to keep to collect the information from all of our counselors, psychs, and social workers about not only kids. We at our district, when a student presents as suicidal, we call and have them transported out of the district by ambulance or whatever else is going on. And I don't have the data on that, but we're going to collect it because it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There are children, Bob probably knows too, but there are children all the time that are so acute in what they're presenting mm-hmm. to their counselors or whatever that a call is made.
We're getting a lot of them in the emergency department.
Oh, you are?
Oh, yeah.
Because we're sending, are you okay?
Oh, yeah.
That makes sense. We're sending them to you routinely. So there's a lot.
Yeah.
I have a question. You spoke regarding Battleground.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other districts? Are you communicating with the other districts, and is there meetings between them, and where are they?
We try. I mean, I have a job in Battleground called the Director of Social Emotional Learning. I know, for instance, Camas just posted that position a couple weeks ago, so other districts are really looking at it, and Evergreen has a similar position in Vancouver as well. And part of what's happening with this is we got the money to do the pilot and pull together a prototype, if you will, about how to get this done. But statewide and nationally, the three aware sites in the state are talking. So I do some communication about that. But we try to work together really closely.
What about as far as Clark County is concerned?
I mean, Cindy's been pulling this all together. We've been, you know, it's just so overwhelming of problems in all the districts. Battleground is not unique. I don't think it's not.
I understand.
Yeah.
We have the school-informed teams in the alliance that's working on, you know, the family resource centers, mm-hmm. and most of the school districts are represented on that again. Yeah, but let me tell you that the time, it's so hard for these, their time at the school, their home job is so difficult to get away. But we have some totally, you know, our family resource center people and some of the social work staff that are working in the schools have gotten together because it's so important that they share the learnings and what's going on. And that's what we're seeing happen in our school team through the alliance.
I will say that it's... this is a community problem. So Bob and I have been talking to our city council in Battleground, and kids go to school during the day. They're all there. So, you know, the schools are doing, in my opinion, what they can, and it's an amazing thing. But think about what schools' basic core functions are. And then think about this whole effort that's going on that they're just stepping up to do because it has to be done. But it's a community problem. And that's why I think a team that looks at like why kids are dying, a death study team in this county needs to take place. Because if people actually knew the extent of this problem and what kids are dealing with every single day in their lives, we're trying so hard to be positive in Battleground, and that's why I started with that whole thing about catching them being positive and catching them, and then Youth Voice. I didn't even go into that, but that's critical to the success of any program.
I think it's safe to say that there's high school counselors in every school every day attending to students who are feeling suicidal.
Yes.
And that was mentioned that counselors, I did get responses that said counselors have resources to direct kids to, but oftentimes, like I said, they're just too afraid to speak up. Mm-hmm. That's another problem, is getting kids to speak up in the first place.
We're actually looking at, in Battleground, we're looking at something called an internalizer screen. And it's a series of questions that have been developed at a research-based level. Very simple questions that we ask teachers to rate kids on. Mm-hmm. Surprise you what the questions are. But to go to kids who are quietly mm-hmm. suffering. Because it's not hard to pick out kids who are loud. But it's the kids that are quiet that are often dying.
You know, another problem is the kids that didn't speak up in high school, that graduate. I'm seeing those 19 to 21-year-old kids every day. Mm-hmm. I get a call from a parent every day.
Mm-hmm. I will say at the community forum, one thing that several parents spoke to is how often it's very difficult to get services for their students.
You know, I wanted to comment, Amy, on what you said about, and I see this. It's this. It's like we need a in our community a youth lens, just as you said, to acknowledge youth instead of dismissing youth. Mm-hmm. You know, you said that, how important that is for youth to be recognized, you know, in the mm-hmm. newsletter, that, you know, you think about what could we do in our community to recognize the youth, you know, of all ages, every, you know, from, you know, it seems that there are things that we could do, and I think there are things that we can do as individuals to just, you know, in a, like I often talk to people about, what, and I know I learned this from Curtis out in Battleground, that, you know, sometimes the first thing to do if a kid whizzes by you on a skateboard is to go, yeah, but to look at that differently and to sort of turn to that kid and say something positive about, boy, you're good on that skateboard, mm-hmm. to acknowledge, to recognize, that would go a long way, because sometimes we tend to be more critical mm-hmm. of our youth than in terms of giving feedback of a kid who's on a skateboard. Kids lack talent to be on a board. You know, and I'm just using that as an example, and that comes from what Curtis has talked about, you know, how, you know, we as adults need to appreciate our youth, and we need to give them that feedback, not just in a newsletter for a group of people, but just what can each one of us do individually.
Mm-hmm. How about a board of all of the different districts composed of the teens?
Mm-hmm. That would be good, I think.
In other words, everybody will get together and you have your teen board. Okay, you
we
spoke
do,
of that in your presentation.
We do have the Youth Commission, which I'm also a part of.
Right.
We've focused on topics similar to this in the past. We are actually looking at toxic stress as mm-hmm. a topic for the future and how that's affecting youth. Mm-hmm. And so I think with this information that you guys have been talking about, I might bring this back to the Youth Commission and start a conversation about it, start talking about it, get some ideas flowing for what we could do, focus on with the coming year.
There's also a youth group called FISBRT. I never can remember exactly what that stands for, but Peggy McCarthy with Naomi Southwest Washington is involved with that. It's FISBRT. I'll find out what that stands for,
okay.
But it is youth, and they when they go, they get a $25 gift card. They get free pizza, all that stuff, just to come in and give their views, opinions, whatever. Every month they meet. I think it's the third Monday of the month.
Wow.
And the youth are invited to come and join, and they get that gift card. They get free pizza. Pretty good deal. And then Clark County has the Youth Awards. I'm not exactly sure what the title of that
is. Oh,
the
Youth Achievement Celebration?
Right.
Yeah, I just spoke at that, the last one, yeah.
Did you? Mm-hmm. My son won a couple of those, and I know it doesn't sound like anything does, and it takes a really long time, sat through two of those. But it really does do things for their self-esteem when they get a thing in the mail that says, hey, somebody's acknowledged that you have achieved in this area or this area, whether it be personal achievement, music, school, whatever. And then there's also, I don't know if anybody's heard of the Youth Mobile Crisis Team that they have now.
Yeah.
I'll get some more information on that as well. But I had tears in my eyes listening to your talk. It is a terrible problem.
One of the things I noticed in all of your presentations was that underlying, you know, importance of having that caring adult, those caring adults. I mean, how, and it seems so simple, but it's not. And I think there's no parent, no matter what the situation, that doesn't absolutely love their child. But to your point, Joan, sometimes, you know, parents are working two or three jobs just to be able to pay for their electricity bill. And the importance of having that one caring adult to augment that love that the parent brings, I think is really, I thought was resonated throughout all of your presentations tonight. And I think that's important as we, you know, think about this as adults with kids in our lives. You know, how can we be a caring adult for a child that may not be our own child, but maybe it's the next door neighbor who's having some issues. Maybe it's, you know, doing a mentoring program in the schools. There's a variety of things that we can do individually to be that caring adult, to serve that role.
SAMHSA actually says that the main way that we can fight this epidemic is through connectedness,
right.
Just that feeling of connectedness to the community. And that goes for anyone with mental health issues. If they alienate and isolate, they're in trouble. So just making sure people are connected in some way.
And that is a big factor of youth suicide, mm-hmm. is isolation, mm-hmm. cutting yourself off. So if you have someone that you're connected to in some way, mm-hmm. that's really important to have that sort of lifeline.
Mm-hmm. Good work, though, everyone does.
So, Amy, I was wondering your perspective, because Joan had mentioned, you know, that there's a lot of mentoring programs that are available in Clark County, and I was wondering if you felt like you or your peers were aware of those mentoring opportunities. Is that something that you frequently hear about in school or ever hear about?
In school, never. I never hear about that stuff in school. If I do hear about something, it's through the Youth Commission or my connections with the Health Board. I personally have tried to bring things to school, you know, and get the word out about the Youth Achievement Celebration or whatever, but it's never something the administration actually does, at least for Ridgefield. I can't speak for all the other schools, but in Ridgefield.
Yeah. It makes me think of, like, what you had mentioned as far as getting the word out, you know, how to make people aware of the services that are available in the community, the efforts that exist.
I know that most schools have newsletters that they do like once a quarter at least. And also, my son was in theater. They had the thing where, you know, the program or whatever, and they had services that were listed for various things. One could be mental health or substance use disorder services in there.
Or social media. I mean, it seems like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It seems to me that just as you're talking, Amy, that somehow, you know, if we as a community could recognize how important it is, there could be some simple things where, let's say, the county counselor would, if, you know, people that were on the honor roll would get a letter saying, thanks for making good grades and making, you know, it's great for our community to know that we have, if you think about where could an idea like that reside, you know, with whether it's elected officials, you know, mayors, you know, really sort of focusing on what can we do to acknowledge our youth in sports, in, you know, academics, in terms of different things, kids that, you know, are involved in activities at school, theater productions, just the simple, you know, that whole issue, people
that are recognized feel connected. And it sometimes recognition is not necessarily the Marshall Award for youth, you know, the big thing, but just the ongoing day-to-day recognition of validating people's contributions.
Yeah, and especially for youth that may not have important,
right,
like parent figures,
that's
like you
right,
talked
that's
about.
Right, yeah.
If they can't, I mean, at least for me, my parents have always been a very good support system, but for another youth that may not have that, getting recognition from someone else outside of their family might be very impactful.
It's just like going to school, you know, getting a letter, if the kid's been struggling and they've been at school and they've had reduced their absences, there'd be a way for them to get a letter that from the council chair, maybe the county chair, sort of saying, mm-hmm, you know, our community is really proud of you for, mm-hmm, you know, signed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems, but we have to, first of all, as a community, recognize how important it is. It's just what you're saying. The youth want to be acknowledged early on, before they get to that point, mm-hmm, down the road.
And we do
I would suggest, though, that the people that are probably, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the people that are thinking of suicide or on the verge of committing suicide are not necessarily those that are at the top of the line and are on, you know, that are recognized for being the student council and all those things. That it's the people that don't feel like they're part of.
It's really ironic. One of the people that we lost in Battleground was a Marshall Award winner. So I don't mean to put a finer point on that, but 20% of the senior class said they thought and contemplated suicide. So we are talking about really a group, a generation of children who we need to do, as a community, a better job of connecting with. And
right,
we're really focusing in Battleground, at least on youth voice, on genuinely inviting kids in to develop, like,
right,
those expectations. You should see the expectations at Prairie High School, because they are not the ones that the adults thought that should be there. For instance, my favorite is in the cafeteria, that one of the expectations is, it's a can, not a cannot. We know you can put your garbage away. I mean, it's just funny. It's the thing that kids developed when they looked at their environment. So it's, anyway, but it's, we have to let go of that idea that this isn't affecting 20% of the kids that we know. What the data says.
Yeah, we had a discussion. I think that it's more acceptable. Kids think it's more acceptable. Suicide is an acceptable option,
yes,
in their life, where it wasn't when I was little. I mean, and so we have to get over it. How do we reach out to the youth? And I loved your presentation, by the way. So I was down there taking notes. So.
Don't they say for depression, like, connection, but then also purpose? I mean, that if kids don't feel like they have a purpose, then, you know, so I mean, I think there's the whole aspect of a mentoring adult, but then also giving kids an opportunity to mentor or to, you know, giving, like you said, they want, what's the reason for them to live, right? So giving them that purpose.
Well, and I think in our case, at least, we have a very rural county. And so bringing the mental health providers into the buildings where they go every day and their parents are comfortable going in and it's mandatory you're there means that there's a reduction of barriers, right? You don't have to transport your kids to downtown Vancouver. You don't have to, you can just go to the school, because, and the providers are amazing. And then kids can access the services down the street in Amboy instead of, they don't drive into Vancouver. So we're really, really trying to build on what we have. But, and every building could do it. There's a model for it. It could happen.
June, I was wondering if in the Alliance, if possibly asking the I don't know if they're called probation officers when they're juveniles or not, I don't know what the term is for them, but if a child has been out of trouble, has it, you know, reoffended or whatever in 6 months or a year or whatever, a letter from, I don't know, the police officer that arrested them or the, you know, someone saying, hey, good work.
Yeah.
We're proud of you for
we're
not
working on that right now,
reoffending.
Sandy and I are working on a program where we do school-based diversion for, it'll be for starting very pilot program will be battleground high school students that commit crimes, certain crimes on the high school campus. They'll work with the school resource officer, the offender's parents, and we'll get them into school-based diversion into Sandy's programs. And at the end of the completion of the diversion, we will take that police report and we'll go to juvenile. And then we will work, you know, recognize the student for, hey, thank you, and the parents for, hey, thank you for completing this program. Mm-hmm. So it makes it more of a positive instead of a negative. And we're going to start that next school year.
Believe it or not, some people, the single most connectedness they have is with their probation officer,
right,
or whatever. I mean, that's the person that's always there trying to get them to do the right thing or keep them in line. That's pretty powerful.
I've seen SROs and ability be the most protective factor for a huge number of children.
Mm-hmm.
They're extremely connected with kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take any adult who shows up.
I heard you.
Yeah.
And going back to the whole recognition thing, I did want to give a quick spiel on the YAC Awards, we call them, Youth Achievement Celebration. And Youth Commission is behind it. So what it is, we recognize around 300 youth from around the county that have received nominations. So we review the nominations and we send out invitations through the mail. You get a letter, open it up, say, congratulations, you've been nominated for the category of family life, sportsmanship, citizenship. I think there are like 13 categories. And then on the day of, you show up around 1:30, I think. And you get recognized, and we have usually have two or three county councilors there. We have members of the kind of our county government there, and your name is called, and you're recognized for the achievements you've made. But that only happens once a year, so I think normalizing recognition could be very helpful.
And the people that are close to you get gold tickets.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Yeah. And we design all of that. We pick colors and all that stuff. So it's very fun.
And cake.
Mm-hmm.
I was always there for the cake.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for to our presenters this evening. And we can give them all a round of applause. And I'm glad that we'll be receiving that information too.
Yeah.
So. One of the last things is wanted to just open up a little bit of time for council member updates. May I understand that, Tracy?
Oh, I do. Yeah, thank you. I last week was busy. I was at a suicide, or not suicide. I've been a lot of places, but mental health, the behavioral health workshop was last week here in Vancouver. They helped, and I met on Wednesday for the suicide prevention piece of it. So that was really good, and that was Wednesday. And then Wednesday night I went up to Seattle, and all day Thursday and half of Friday, I was at the governor's opioid summit. It was put together by the State Patrol, the Attorney General's Office, and the Prosecuting Attorneys Association. It was targeting primarily law enforcement. The governor mandated something needs to be done, pull yourselves together, and let's come up with some ideas. And there was a huge group of wonderful presenters that were there. One of them is Barry McCaffrey, who's former director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, so he's a pretty heavy hitter there talking, and he's very passionate. There were a lot of statistics, there are all of those kinds of things, but what I found interesting in all throughout, kind of sprinkled around, were references to ACEs, references to suicide, references to all sorts of things that we talk about often here. Some of the demographic at the meeting for the day and a half were not only law enforcement, there were members from other health departments, social workers, all kinds of counselors, nurses, the list just goes on and on. There were school district people there as well. And so we did talk about a lot of the statistics, which, you know, are staggering.
But one of the things that, Snohomish County is doing is partnering with agencies to come out to actually go out into the drug houses and take social workers and people that can be of help with them rather than going and busting them. So they're trying to put on a friendlier face, and it's according to them, it's working. They're seeing some results. There were who else was there? There were a lot of speakers there. They had an agenda, and they kept on track very well. We talked about the prescription monitoring program here in the state, and for law enforcement and nurse practitioners, physician assistants, physicians. That's if you're in the system, use it. There was a speaker from that program also. But the next day, also healthcare fraud and diversion was there. The federal crimes for diverting, you know, all of this. So they were a really interesting group. But on Friday, I went. They had breakout sessions, and I went to. I had to pick two, and I was assigned. So the first one I went to was curbing demand through public education and outreach, and. One of them that resonated with me, and you guys maybe know her, is Gabrielle Richard. Do you know who she is? Mm-hmm. She's with prevention. She's a prevention system manager. I don't know if Sandy might know her. She talked about the StopOverdose.org, and their partners include OSPI and ESD 112. And the program is called PREVENT, and it was in all caps with an exclamation point behind it. And they have been in Camas, Vancouver, and Battleground High School. And my notes are a little, I'm hoping I get this right. They train presenters to go to schools. Do you know,
right.
You know who I'm talking about?
Well, it's not, Gabrielle isn't the name, but yeah, PREVENT
well,
is in.
She's like not local here, but she works with that group and works with all of that. And so, I just thought it was really interesting that everything we do, we're all sort of very connected. And there is support out there, and I did talk to her. I just asked a quick question because I talked, you know, like Roxanne said, our parents have got two or three jobs. And the what I heard from us, off and on throughout the day and a half conference was, we need to engage the parents. And like Sandy said, it's not a school problem. It's a community problem, whether it's opioids or suicide prevention or whatever. So she did have some resources. I did not talk to her about what those were as far as being able to engage those parents that are not, who, although they may want to be, like you said, love their children very much, but are not able to be as engaged, and so you know there are those kinds of resources out there as well. So it was a busy end of the week, and it was really good. Then the other one that I attended was legislative, which would be probably really boring for all of you guys because I thought that was really good, but that's a whole other thing for me. So anyway, it was really good, and I just wanted to put it out there that it was a huge amount of work by the State Patrol and everyone that put it together, and with all of the speakers and things that we had, and that the work that we do, it is definitely all connected. So it was very good. So I just wanted to share that. If you need any information or interested in any information, I'll give you what I have, which isn't a lot, but.
Can I say something to that? On Wednesday, I had this dental thing going on, and I, believe it or not, I know four or five people that went to the dentist on Wednesday to have a tooth pulled. I'm not kidding you. And the thing about the opioids is that people have either gone all the way to the other side, where a number of the people that I spoke to said, oh, well, my doctor didn't even give me anything for pain, which I can't. They're going, you know, take the ibuprofen. Well, when you get to be my age, which is older than Amy is, It hurts because that tooth's been in your head for a long time. Now, for me, I wouldn't get out of the chair until he gave me a prescription, which unfortunately I was allergic to. The pharmacist said I was allergic to it. I took it, woke up, thought I was dying, called the next day. They were very ugly to me about the fact that I was calling for something else. My son took the prescription to them. They wrote another prescription that I took to the pharmacy. The pharmacist this time called him and said, she cannot take this medication. One was oxycodone and then one was hydrocodone or whatever, because I have a codeine allergy, right? They said, well, the dentist said, well, what prescription do you want us to write you? I don't think that they know other prescriptions to write. I think they've been writing the oxycodone and the hydrocodone for so long, they really don't know anything else to write. So I had to get through my problem with no medication. The other people that I know either were told that they wouldn't give them any medication at all. And if we have pills that are for pain, and a person is in pain, we shouldn't force them to, you know, be in pain rather than have some relief, even if you give them two pills, you know, to be in relief from that pain, because the body heals better when it's not in pain, in my opinion. And I really feel like of all the people that I talked to, that Wednesday was a really bad day for teeth. And not only that, but I learned that either people, especially low income, are not getting any kind of consideration when it comes to pain in their mouth. Because a couple of the people I spoke to were medical recipients and they got nothing at all and were told that the dentist never prescribes anything. And then in my situation, being prescribed things I couldn't take. And, you know, it's just, I know that's a huge problem, but I think a lot of the problem is because they don't know anything else to prescribe. There's plenty of medication. The PDR is like that thick now. There's plenty of things that they could prescribe that would be, you know, inhibitors to the pain, but not opioid or narcotic or something. Give us a tube of Orajel. I don't know. Just to send people out of there in pain. It was... That's my soapbox.
Data from the drug monitoring program, though, right? Just off the top of my head, they looked at first opiate prescription for 14 to 19-year-olds, first time visiting, mm-hmm. and the average number of pills, these are opiates, 14 to 19-year-olds, and this is around the state, were somewhere in the 20s. Now, why would you give 20 opiate pills? Actually, the dentists were kind of like in the 20s, so were the primary care docs. The orthopedists, if I remember correctly, the average, the mean was 48 pills. One first time for 14 to 19-year-old, and I think the 90th percentile was more like 70. I think a lot of times they give out, physicians, healthcare providers will give out far more pills than obviously some have. Who needs 22 oxycodone for a tooth extraction or something like that?
Right.
But the way the whole system works, they don't want you to have to people to come back or be called again. So there's a lot of work going around the state giving physicians feedback about
mm-hmm.
giving them access to the data so physicians will get feedback and their medical directors for some of these larger systems can see who's prescribing a lot of them, but there's still large, way too many. You know, I was just talking about 14 to 19-year-olds getting a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
so there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that it did not dawn on me, and I thought of you, Adrian, because people will take, you probably know what I'm going to say.
Animal tranquilizer.
It's awful.
Well, I was thinking about how much
they will go to
prescription medication that veterinarians and myself included prescribe for long term.
And legitimately, because what they'll do is they'll go get an animal from a shelter and they will hurt it, take it to the vet to get the pain medication, and then kill the animal anyway. I
was not thinking about that. So terrible, you know. But I am thinking about medication. Mostly, we don't use a lot of hydrocodone. It's one of the stronger, more abused.
Yeah, I just kidding about that.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I don't think that there's enough prescribing.
Yeah.
But I did file a complaint with the health department.
With the state health department.
All right, so we have reached that 8 o'clock hour. I'm wondering how you would feel about a journey. Is there a motion to adjourn?
I would move to adjourn.
Second.
Okay.